You're listening to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Fantasy Baseball. I'm John Cook, joined by my co-host Patrick Fitzgerald, and our guest for this week, pitcher list writer Martin Sokolsky. In this episode, we're going to go over Martin's article previewing potential AL prospects that might be making their way to the majors next season, and then we'll wrap it up by looking back at the over and under performers from last season, specifically a few hitters. Before we get into all that, just a reminder, you can follow our podcast on Twitter at ThisWeekPL. Send us your fantasy baseball questions to our email at ThisWeekPLpod@gmail.com. Lastly, make sure you subscribe to or follow the podcast and whatever streaming platform you listen to. We're on all of them, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you listen. Make sure you give us a follow and leave a five-star review if you enjoy the show. But as I mentioned, we are joined today by pitcher list writer Martin Sokolsky. Martin, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me again. Nice to see you, John. It's been probably about a year since we recorded last. I think our last conversation was about the three Jacksons, Merrill, Churio, and Holiday. So it's been a while, and nice to see Patrick as well. So,
yeah, it's been a fun time. Obviously, busy time for the Dynasty team. You guys are putting out a bunch of articles. How has been this year for you, kind of just in terms of fantasy baseball and maybe even real baseball, although I know that wasn't maybe the greatest experience this season for you.
Yeah, the Red Sox, I mean, they did better than I thought they would. They got to a game, you know, winner take all game in the Bronx, and that's more than I would have ever expected. As far as fantasy goes, kind of an up and down year. I finished second in my TGFBI league, which is probably my favorite thing I did all year because I finished dead last in the previous two seasons. So that was encouraging, and just putting out a lot of content over at the Dynasty team for Pitcher List. We've got so much stuff coming out, so keep an eye on that, especially as we approach the new year.
Yeah, I know you also had the fun job of putting out together Dynasty rankings, which I'm sure is not easy, but nonetheless a very helpful tool for us Dynasty managers who are just trying to figure out, yeah, where do people rank? So definitely appreciate that work. Yep. But yeah, we are going to be talking about your article on potential AL prospects that might be making their way to the majors in 2026. A lot of good names here. We're only going to focus on the stars. You had a couple different tiers in this one, basically players that could be, you know, starters, players that were, you know, replacement level guys, and then my favorite, just a guy, you know, guys that, you know, might make it up as, you know, organizational depth, maybe a, you know, not even like maybe a fourth outfielder, but a guy who gets called up maybe a couple times, but, you know, just won't be fantasy relevant. But as this is a fantasy baseball show, we are going to focus on those who are viable fantasy assets. But before we get into really just kind of the individual players here, what were your thought process when you're, you know, kind of putting together this article? Because I think you had put together this article last year as well, or is this your first time putting it together?
Nope, this is the second year I've done this one. I'm also working on the pitcher version, which will come out, I think, on the 22nd. I did the American League for both sides, and then Matt Heckman took the National League for both sides. So the overall thought process basically is just this proximity, right? Guys that have either played at least in double A, ideally triple A, but a lot of guys have been making that jump over the triple A level, especially like in the Angels organization where they pretty much don't even use triple A at all. And then just the skills that guys possess, you know, the elite power, the elite speed, things like that. And then I guess the other thing is just a possible path to playing time. There's a lot of open positions right now, and there's a lot of off season to go. I realize that. So it's a fine line to walk. But when you're identifying 50 players, at the position, you know, in hitter positions and then 50 pitchers, you have to take a couple of reaches here and there. So some of the guys that are on the article, probably fringe guys, but these guys are the stars, and hopefully they'll get where they need to get to this year.
Yeah, and out of those 50, we're only going to be covering 12 in this podcast. So definitely check out Martin's article if you're just, you know, prepping for next year and just seeing what your prospect pool looks like in your dynasty teams, or, you know, if there's maybe a stash that you want to look at in your redraft leagues if, you know, you're already drafting for those. But we're going to start out with some guys on the fringe. And I really like that you put these guys in this list because I think they are stars. You know, they are kind of household names in terms of dynasty fantasy, but they're also names that, you know, people are just starting to get to know, because like you said, you know, they've only been really in the high A or double A range. But we're going to start with a group of guys, Leo DeVries out of the Athletics, Laz Montez with the Mariners, and Xavier Isaac with the Rays. And so with these three guys, you know, what kind of sets them apart as, you know, really young players, but guys that you think could potentially make an impact in 2026?
Yeah, we'll start with DeVries. I mean, just the pure talent level from a kid that's just, he just turned 19 in October. He got to double A last year as an 18-year-old and hit 255 with 15 homers and 11 steals. And that includes being traded in the middle of the season, which I still can't believe that AJ Preller did that, but it is what it is. So the plate skills are very advanced for him. His 12% walk rate last year. And then the power is really starting to come around as well. The interesting thing with DeVries is that he's really getting to the power more from the left side. That right side has not really been there. He was sub 700 OPS from the right side against left-handed pitching. I think that'll probably even out in time. But right now that power stroke is definitely from the left side. That's where he's doing the most damage. So as far as he goes, I mean, he's going to have to switch positions most likely. I believe they're pretty set on Jacob Wilson there. He's a good defender. He's got a good bat. DeVries is capable of playing third. He's got the arm to play third, and he can also slide over to second as well. The big thing with DeVries is there's a potential path to playing time now with the A's organization. You know, Zach Gelof's been kind of disappointing. They don't really have anybody at third base either. So definitely a path to playing time, and they can get really aggressive if they want to. Will they? I don't know, but I think they've shown with especially Nick Kurtz last year, they're not afraid to dig into their prospects and try to make an impact.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of interesting you mentioned the path to playing time there, because obviously everyone, when the trade initially happened, it was, hey, Jacob Wilson is, you know, depending on what stat you look like, one of the better shortstops right now in the American League, or young shortstops for sure. And so it felt kind of weird that, you know, that's the trade that the A's make. But I think when a guy of DeVries' talent is available, you take it. So, yeah, definitely an interesting move there to get him. But it's interesting that you mentioned, yeah, you know, the situation at second and at third for the A's is, you know, not set in stone at all. So it's definitely a possibility that he could get called up to, you know, fill one of those spots if they feel like there's nothing left for him to prove in the minors.
Yeah, so we'll talk about Montez next. So Montez is a big guy. I mean, 6'5", 220. He just turned 21 recently, so there's legitimate 70-grade power there. He's getting to it with ease. He's got back-to-back 20-homer seasons, including 32 this year. And the thing that really stood out to me as I was digging into Montez is that he hit 14 home runs in AA Arkansas. And if anyone's followed the Mariners' prospects and their development, especially the hitters, Arkansas is not a great place to hit. A lot of guys really start to dip when they go there. Guys like Harry Ford and Michael Arroyo struggled a little bit there this year as well. So it's not an easy place to hit, and Montez made it look really, really easy. Going to be some swing and miss in the profile, but he's kind of got – he's just so good with the power that he's gonna play. He's going to be a long-term DH, obviously, but the Mariners need that kind of thump in their lineup. I know they had a great run last year, and they've just, you know, they bring back guys like Naylor, and obviously Julio Rodriguez is the star there. But Montez could definitely give him a big boost down the stretch. So,
is it weird to kind of have a guy that young penciled in as DH? You know, it just in terms of just positional need or things like that. I mean, I think of, you know, the Mariners, you know, obviously Cal Raleigh's there. He's going to be probably behind the plate for a while, but he does DH sometimes. Julio Rodriguez, you know, does DH mm-hmm. a couple times as well. Does it make sense for a guy like for Montez to be, you know, seen as a primary DH coming up into the majors?
I mean, given his lack of speed and range in the outfield, I would say yes. I mean, there's always the potential they could flip him to first base, but then Josh Naylor's there. So ideally, that's not the path that you want to take to have him be a primary DH, but I think that that's his path to the show. And ultimately, if they decide to make some moves, maybe he's a trade piece, but there's a lot of talent there, and someone's going to get that power at some point, and, you know, down the road, and hopefully it's in Seattle, but if it goes somewhere else, then he's, for me, he's going to be a DH. So
got it.
Yeah, and if you look at like the last couple of years with Montes, it seems like he's on track for kind of two level seasons every year with that mid-level promotion each or mid-season promotion each year. But I guess once you get to AAA, right, all bets are off, especially, you know, when a team's trying to compete as much as Seattle is, and you know they really need as many average bats in their lineup as they can get, right?
Yeah, they did that with Michael Arroyo as well. Arroyo was originally on this list, but kind of took him off. I'm not confident that he gets up this year, but he's got that same kind of process, right? So he starts at the level he was at the year before, plays, you know, 30, 40 games there, then moves up a level, and then repeats the same thing next year. So that's why I think he's going to start this coming season in Double A, and maybe he gets the Triple A. They could be aggressive with him as well, but it's just kind of their process with him. So, and then Xavier Isaac, same thing kind of with Montes. The power is really good. He's got a future 80 grade power according to FanGraphs. He's had some pretty productive seasons with home runs, but he only had 9 last year. Obviously, there's a huge story that came out over the last month about a brain surgery that he had to have in July. So very scary, especially for a kid that's only 21, but I hope he's doing well. And I'm really looking forward to seeing, you know, him back on the field this year. Contact issues are very, 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 very important for Isaac. He's got the potential to swing himself completely out of baseball, but he's also got the power to turn into a 40 homer bat. So if he can find that happy medium, make league average contact, he's a guy that really has the potential to do some special things with his bat.
Yeah, and for Isaac, I mean, you mentioned in the article his strikeout rate finally gets below 30% in 2025. But of course, because the season is cut short, you know, how much stock can you take in that number? Did have a crazy walk rate of just under 20% as well, but clearly something for him to continue working on. But, and, you know, maybe, you know, I think maybe I put him on this list of guys in the fringe in just the sense that he's only played 41 games at Double A. You know, the Rays could, you know, easily keep him in Double A or Triple A this season just to get more seasoning and just get more at bats, as he is only 21. So there's still, you know, plenty of time for his game to develop.
Absolutely.
All right. We're going to move on to a guy who I think a lot of people expected him to get in the majors this past season, but he didn't. And that's Spencer Jones of the New York Yankees. I mean, his skills, I think, are a lot of people already kind of know. You know, really solid power hitter, you know, maybe not necessarily the next Aaron Judge, but I'm sure he looks like it a little bit at 6'7". But yeah, what's kind of the things that stand out about Spencer Jones that could make him a star in the majors next year?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the power. I mean, 35 homers this past season. You know, he's got a 70 grade power tool hung up on him as well. The EVs are very high, almost a 95 mile an hour per hour. Average EV with a 114 max, which is obviously very impressive. And then the thing that people don't realize about Jones is how athletic he is. I remember hearing a lot of talk. I believe it was Chris Welsh that talked about this agility test, these special tests that they give to these athletes when they're in these, you know, development places like Driveline and places like that. And Jones grades out off the charts, like freakishly athletic. He's a guy that his size, I mean, he's 6'7", like you mentioned, he's going to steal 20 bags in the majors and he's going to do it with ease. So, I mean, we're talking about a guy that's potentially got the power for 50 home runs, could steal you 20 bases. I mean, we're at that point where, especially in that ballpark, I mean, he could do some big time damage, but then there's the contact issues. So they've got the end zone rate is only 72%, 60% overall contact rate, which is not great. And then the 35% chase rate. So a little bit of everything, right? It's kind of that three true outcomes, but he's going to swipe a lot of bases and going to hit a lot of home runs. And right now, I think he's got a potential to break camp with the Yankees. I mean, they're going to do something, you would think, with their free agency. But if they decide to lead on the young kids, he's a guy that's going to get a shot. He's going to get a shot early on.
Yeah, I think 29 stolen bases last year between AA and AAA. But yeah, 35% strikeout rate, combined with like a little over 11% walk rate. So some positives there. But I mean, yeah, looking at the outfield right now for the Yankees, I mean, they just signed Amed Rosario, but I mean, he could be really just kind of a utility sort of person. Judge and Wright. Grisham's back, obviously getting that qualifying hour in center, qualifying offer in center. In left right now, Roster Resource has Jason Dominguez penciled in, but you know we could easily see them swap him for Jones. So yeah, definitely some interesting spots for him. But yeah, with that idea that he could potentially break camp, is this a guy that you want on your roster, even in a redraft league?
I mean, depending on the depth of the league, yes. I would want him in like a draft and hold, 50-round draft and hold. And then the shallower leagues, I don't think he's really rosterable because he doesn't have a definite spot on the roster. But if, you know, in mid-March, if he's, you know, trending toward making the opening day roster, his ADP is just going to go through the roof and guys are going to take chances on him just because the upside is so massive. So,
yeah. All right. Next, we're going to go to the AL Central with Brandon Montgomery of the White Sox, who you probably are familiar with a little bit because he was the Red Sox first-round pick in 2024, involved in that Garrett Crochet deal. But yeah, what's kind of the cool thing about Montgomery? What kind of makes him a guy that you think could be a really solid player in the majors next year?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with Montgomery is I've been really impressed with his perseverance. I mean, he's had a couple of kind of freakish injuries. He had broke his ankle during Super Regionals at Texas A&M, and then he wasn't able to debut as a result of that. And then he broke his foot this past season. He still did get to 450 plate appearances and then played out in the AFL as well. The tools are really loud. The power is the biggest thing. But he's also a guy that's going to be able to hit for a decent average. Definitely doesn't have the same level of power as Jones and Isaac, but he's a guy that I'm very confident will hit for a much higher average. There is a little bit of strikeout concerns as well, but he's still quite young, and those strikeouts aren't as pronounced as the guys that we've already hit on. And then, you know, with the White Sox, there's just so much rebuild going on. When he's ready, he's going to come up. They're not going to hold him back. I mean, they probably won't get the PPI pick if they bring him up this year, because I don't think he's going to be up that early to win the Rookie of the Year, but he's a guy that's going to impact that organization for a really long time. I would love to have him in Boston, but I like Garrett Crochet a lot more. So,
yeah, that kind of worked out pretty well. Yeah. I mean, the outfield for the White Sox, it's Luis Robertson Jr., Ben Attendee, and Brooks Baldwin, which is, you know, not exactly a murderous row of offensive talent right there. So, yeah, definitely plenty of opportunities for Montgomery to come up. But it sounds like you kind of think he's not, you know, breaking camp with the major league team. He's probably going to still be in the minors for a couple months before he gets called up.
Yeah, I don't think he's quite ready. I mean, he's not that far off as far as tools go, but there's still a level of maturity that he's got to get to at the plate with plate discipline and things like that. And he really, I mean, 450 plate appearances in the minors isn't really a lot. So yeah, I think he'll be up this year for sure. It's just a matter of when.
So going from Montgomery in the AL Central to a couple of other big guys, you know, in the same division, one of them, former top pick, Travis Bazzano, right, who's maybe a star, has kind of fallen a little bit, and then a guy who's just kind of rising like a meteor is Kevin McGonigal. So how do you kind of see those guys, you know, comparing to one another? Has McGonigal kind of just crossed over Bazzano and continuing to put distance between them, or where are you at on these two guys for this year?
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty high on McGonigal. I know it's bold, but I can't see them finding 26 guys on that roster that are better than he is. I mean, I saw him out in Arizona, the AFL. The kid's incredible. He's arguably the best pure hitter in the minors. I mean, he hit 305 this year across three different levels in the minor leagues, and then went out to Arizona, won the AFL MVP. I've heard many people talk about his approach when he was out in the Arizona Fall League and how a lot of guys, you know, they want the extra reps, but he was a guy that was completely locked in from day one. And you could see that when you watched him play. He's a pro. He's looking forward to being a pro, and he's going to do some really impressive things. There's a ton of hit tool there. The contact rates are just incredible. He's not going to chase. The biggest thing with him is, where is he going to play defensively? I mean, he could play shortstop for sure. They've got Gleyber Torres that's going to clog up second base. I can't imagine they'd move Torres back to short based on his, you know, experience in New York, but they've also got Baez. They could play it short as well, but McGonigal can play third. He played third almost exclusively in the AFL, which may have been them tipping their hand a little bit on that. So, but yeah, he's definitely passed Bazzana. I still think there's a lot to like with Bazzana, though. I think that his adjustment to the U.S. game is still in process. I mean, he didn't come to the U.S. until 2022. He was a star at Oregon State, became the number one pick. But there's still that adjustment period, right? And he's got the tools. He's got a lot of power in the bat. He's getting to the EVs. He's getting to the launch angle. Like, he's getting to the pull side power. So it's going to come. He's going to be a high, you know, high OBP guy. He's going to walk a lot. There's going to be some issues with strikeouts. That's kind of been his calling card since he's gotten up to the pro level. But he's still a really good player, and the Guardians really need that bat in their lineup. So McGonagall has definitely blown right past Bazzana for sure, and pretty much past everyone not named Connor Griffin. But Bazzana is going to be—he's going to be a good pro. He just needs a little more adjustment period.
Yeah, it seems like maybe he's the type of guy who gets a little bit more of a bump in OBP leagues just because the average is a little low, but he's really patient. So maybe one of those like more valuable in real life than fantasy type hitters, but I guess we'll see what it looks like once he does get to the big leagues.
Yeah, I mean, if he can get into 20 homers, I mean, he's not going to run much. He did run a little bit at Oregon State, but I can't see that being a part of his game in the majors. But he's a guy that's going to slot in the middle of that order. And with Jose Ramirez there, you know, they still – for now have Stephen Kwan there. He's going to get some RBI opportunities. He's going to get some runs opportunities. He's going to be a really good player for a long time.
And I mean, I'm just looking at, again, roster resource, but you know, right now they've got Colt Keith penciled in at third, Zach McKinstry at short. So I think you could definitely make an argument that McGonagall could outperform McKinstry for sure. You know, maybe Colt Keith as well. And then with Bazzana, right now they've got Gabriel Arias at second. So it's not exactly a logjam that's preventing him from getting to the majors there as well. Exactly. If he stays at second base. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to keep these close because I know these players really well, but maybe the other people don't. The Minnesota Twins, they've got a trio of guys who I was surprised that you listed all three of these guys as stars, but I will take it. Emmanuel Rodriguez, Walker Jenkins, and Kalen Culpepper. I think most people know Walker Jenkins because obviously top five pick a couple years back. I was actually surprised that you had him in this and not Max Clark of the Tigers, but we could talk about that at a different time. But yeah, two of these guys, Rodriguez and Jenkins, both in the outfield. We'll talk about Culpepper in a second, but with either of those two, you know, what do you like about their games and, you know, what makes them guys that you think would be real, like, difference makers in the majors next year?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be the first to admit I'm not really high on Emmanuel Rodriguez. I mean, there's so many concerns with durability. We know what he's capable of when he's healthy, but he hasn't stayed healthy. I mean, it's been ankles and hamstrings and obliques and hips and thumbs. I mean, this is an organization, as you know, John, has been completely snake bitten by injuries with their prospects. Royce Lewis, Alex Kirilloff, Walker Jenkins, who we're going to talk about. So Rodriguez is just, he's just never been on the field. He's never gotten over 100 games played. He's only played 112 the last two seasons combined. When he's healthy, he's an elite on base guy. He's going to draw a lot of walks, but that's also his detriment too. He's striking out over 30% of the time because he's too passive. And then if you look at his contact rates really aren't great either. I mean, he's not far much farther down or up the chart than Spencer Jones is. But at the same time, like, it's that chase the lottery effect is what I call it. If you've got limited bullets, why waste them in the minor leagues? If he's only going to get you 80 games, he's probably going to benefit your major league team more than he's going to benefit AAA. So that's why I've got him on this list. I'm not a huge fan because I've been burned by him in so many different leagues, like the potential. But when he's healthy, he's a good player. So, and then Walker Jenkins. Yeah, it's the same thing, right? So it's injuries. He's had a lot of leg things. He's had the hamstring, the ankle, the quad. But he's a guy that's just a complete athlete. He's a big physical kid. He's very quick. He's got really good OBP skills. The only thing that I'm worried about is the power, and I don't know why it's not come yet. I mean, maybe it's because of the legs. You know, legs are a very important part of the swing and all the different mechanisms that go with that, but the power just hasn't come yet. He's had some max EVs like in the 110s, and I think he's going to be a 20 homer guy, but he hasn't shown that yet. And the other thing is with the legs, will he run? because the speed's there. He's got the agility. He's an athletic kid. He could steal 20 bases in his sleep. But with those injuries, do they worry about it? I mean, they've seen the Royce Lewis thing. They've had these bad situations with injuries where they may just say, you know what, don't run, just hit. So, but he's a guy that's, you know, 2020, I think, if the power comes. So.
Yeah, with Jenkins, his numbers just look so weird because they look extremely pedestrian when you look at them. And then you're like, how is this guy the number one prospect for the Twins? And, you know, like a top 100 guy or a top 50 guy. And then Erod, you look at the numbers. And if you don't, you know, look at games played, they look great. But then, you know, you realize he just kind of missed half the season. And then the third guy, Kalen Culpepper, which I think is maybe less of a household name, but I think he's been shooting up top prospect lists over the last season. Play shortstop, so, you know, not necessarily the outfielder that Jenkins or Rodriguez is. But yeah, Culpepper, anything from him that you know think points to a really could be a good year next year?
Yeah, I mean, this is a kid that is, I mean, for me, he's the quietest top 100 prospect in baseball. He's incredibly underrated. His first full year was last year. He got to Double A. He hit 289, 375, 469 with 20 homers and 25 steals. Sub 20% strikeout rate, almost a 10% walk rate. I mean, he's a collegiate bat from Kansas State. He was a good player there. He kind of is just flying under the radar because he's just going about his business quietly. But there's a lot to like here. He's a really good defender. He could play shortstop. I don't know what their situation is. They've got so many guys that are just kind of floating around that infield.
A lot of former shortstops.
Yeah, right. The Brooks Lees of the world and guys like that. So, but this is a guy that's got, he's got some power. The EVs haven't been like, wow, kind of thing, but he's getting a 113 max. That's pretty impressive. I mean, there's just a really good baseball player here. And this is a guy that if they want to be aggressive, they could bring him up really, really early on. And I hate to say it, but Royce Lewis is going to get hurt at some point. Like, we know it's going to happen. I hate that it happens, but Culpepper's a guy they could easily slot in at third base and be an above average defender there. So I really like Culpepper, and he's a guy that if you don't have him in your dynasty leagues, I would pay up to get him because I think he's going to be special.
All right. So then out of those three, any of them making the opening day roster?
Rodriguez is the most logical. Will he do it? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he's healthy, there's no reason why he shouldn't just be up because he's, like I said, those limited bullets. I don't know what he's going to come up with, and you just got to let him play. You got to see what you have. And if it's not going to work, it's not going to work. But I would say Jenkins isn't going to be far behind because I think they're going to be aggressive with him as well.
Yeah, I agree. And that the outfield is not, it's very replaceable. Let's just say that. Got, you know, potentially Larnach and Wallner in the corners. Obviously Buxton's not moving from center. And then, yeah, there's definitely plenty of opportunity to replace either of those bats with, frankly, just another power lefty bat. So,
yeah, and if they're serious about not trading Lopez and Joe Ryan, then that means that they think they're going to compete or at least be relevant. And that's not a great division to begin with. I mean, Detroit and Cleveland are both solid. The Royals are a good ball club as well. But that division's up for grabs. And if they can bring in that kind of talent that could be potentially special and give that offense a boost – they're going to do it. They're going to be aggressive with it.
Yeah. And Rodriguez on the 40 man already. So, you know, one of those hurdles that we sometimes think about in prospect promotion, don't have to worry about that with him. So that's nice.
Yeah.
All right. One player that I thought maybe I should include him on that fringe list, but I mean, he's been playing really well. Colt Emerson of the Mariners, 2023 pick, but it's already a Triple A. As of last year. And so kind of what we were just talking about a little bit earlier with Montez about, you know, the Mariners potentially, you know, having this mid season call up. Well, he's already made it to AAA. So, you know, assuming he starts in AAA this year, maybe that means he does make the majors. But really young guy, just only 20 years old. But what have you liked from him in his professional career so far?
Yeah, you're right. He's not going to be 21 until July. There's a pretty good chance that he'll be in the majors before he can crack a beer, which is pretty impressive. The hit tool is really strong. The power is kind of coming around. It's not really great right now. He's more of a gap-to-gap line drive hitter, but he draws a lot of walks. His strikeout rate's manageable. Like, it's not like Spencer Jones, but it's not, you know, elite. So he's just a good ball player. There's not really any tools that really stand out for him. It's just a collection of things. He kind of gives me that Matt Shaw vibe, where Shaw was, he's a good prospect, but nothing is a standout tool. There's no 80 grade power. There's no 70 grade speed. He's just solid in every facet of the game. So the issue that I have is that they love J.P. Crawford, and they've made it clear that they love J.P. Crawford. So he's not going to play shortstop. But second base is a wide open gap right now, especially with Polanco leaving. Cole Young isn't it. Ryan Bliss isn't it. So if Emerson can come out hot in the spring, he's a guy that could be their opening day second baseman, and it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, there's still a lot of offseason to go, like we said, but the talent's there. And he very quietly got up to AAA last year. So they know that they know what he's capable of, and they're confident in him as a player. So maybe they give him that shot.
Yeah, I'm even curious if his kind of contact ability maybe plays into being a little bit better at T-Mobile. Like, yeah, I mean, if you don't have the power, it's going to suck at T-Mobile. But if you've got a good all-fields approach like that, that can help a little bit in one of those, you know, bigger stadiums for sure. All right, and then wrapping it up, a guy who's even younger, but Sebastian Walcutt, which initially I was going to put him on that fringe list, but you made a really good point in your article, which is that Marcus Semien's gone. So the middle of that infield is a little wide open. Obviously, you've got Corey Seager at short, but second base is open now, essentially. But yeah, Walcutt, even younger at 19, what kind of made you think, yeah, he's got a shot to be in the league in 2026?
Yeah, I mean, it's along the same lines as DeVries, right? It's very, very loud tools for a kid that's a teenager. I mean, 19 years old in Double A last year, you know, 13 homers, 32 steals, sub 20% strikeout rate, 12% walk rate. You've heard this all before. The contact skills have slowly ticked up a little bit each season. I think it was around like 73% overall contact rate last year. The speed is very good. The power is quite good as well. And if you look at the construction right now of the Rangers, I mean, you've got Josh Smith right now as their everyday second baseman. I don't think that that's where they want him to be. I think that they like to be able to move him around quite a bit. Josh Young is never healthy and hasn't stayed healthy for any extended period of time. Walcott's got the ability to play third base as well. He's had some issues defensively. He had almost 25 errors this past year at shortstop in Double A. It's not great. And then he went out to the AFL and he got shut down with some arm fatigue. So that kind of is looming large right now as we get closer to spring training. That they didn't really ever say anything about it. So I don't think he's an opening day roster kind of guy for sure. I think that they know what they've got. They don't want to put too much on him. But he's a guy that really should start in AAA, and he won't be there. He won't be there very long if they're going to plan on starting Josh Smith every day. They'll find room for him because the talent just outweighs everything that could come with it. So,
yeah, one thing I guess that's interesting about Walcott, I mean, we don't really have any sort of stat casting on him because he didn't get to AAA this year. Mm-hmm. Fangraphs has him as a future 70 power guy, game power, and then 80 raw power. Mm-hmm. He only had 13 homers last year, though. You know, what evidence do we have of that he could grow into that? He's just 19. We don't have any Statcast data on him. But I guess part of the gamble is that he is going to grow into that power as he, you know, matures into his body. I think that's the assumption, right?
Yeah, he's got that. He's really, you know, kind of lanky. He's got that real whippy kind of quick twitch, you know, with his hands. His bat speed's elite. DeVries is elite as well as far as bat speed. That's what's making these guys tick up so much on that power potential, is that bat speed. I mean, it's proven to be, you know, somewhat representative of future success. So, but yeah, just he's going to grow into his body a little bit more. He's still, you know, super young. He's probably going to add, you know, 10, 20 pounds of muscle. So we'll put him around like 200 pounds for 6'3". And with those quick hands and that quick bat, there's going to be some pop there. 80 grade raw is pretty high, though. I gotta admit on that. I can't go there, but I think he's a guy that's, you know, probably 60, 65 future power that'll play.
Okay. They currently have a 60 raw power guy. So apparently Fangraphs is really, really thinks the power is already coming around. So
yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah. I think it's so hard to tell because like, he has a 117 max EV, I think, for his career, which is close to that, you know, upper echelon, but he's not realizing it, right? And I think a lot of that is probably because he's being challenged so much at the level for his age. Like, I was thinking about Vladdy Jr., his career, I was just looking at it, his career minor league record for home runs in a season was 20, right? So he's a guy who's a, you know, a perennial 25 to 30 home run hitter and has that, you know, 80 grade raw power. But he didn't always show it in the minors, and he was also super young at every level. So I'm not saying Walcott's going to hit 300 like Vladdy, right? But I think there might be some parallels there in terms of raw power and you know, age to level challenges and that type of thing.
Yeah, I think he's more likely to hit 30 home runs than he is to hit 270.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the Fangraphs, funny enough, like a comparison to Tatis. I was looking at Tatis's numbers, and yeah, the most homers he hit in the minors was 22. in a year across a single A and double A. So yeah, maybe the stats aren't everything, which I think we're all aware of, you know, they only tell some of the story. So yeah. Very helpful to know. But yeah, that is just a smattering of some of the prospects that you covered in this article. You know, we didn't even talk about guys that aren't stars but could be legitimate starters in the majors next year. So definitely check out that article if you haven't already, and as well as, you know, Matt's article on National League hitting prospects. But before we let you go, Martin, as you mentioned, you've got the pitching prospects version of this article coming out. Obviously, the Dynasty team is really busy with the team analysis coming up in January. I look at that, the top prospects from each team, but anything else coming out for you in the next couple months? And also, you know, how can people kind of follow your work on social media?
Yeah. So the pitching article will be out. I think it's like the 22nd is the go date for that. I'm at like 6,200 words, and I've got some of the AL West to go. So it's going to be another long article, but so yeah, it's coming out. And then I think in January, we're going to get into team by team previews, where we're going to break down the top 20 prospects from each organization. I think I've got 5 teams on my radar for that, if I'm not mistaken. And then we're just going to push forward toward opening day rankings. And, you know, I'm sure Matt and I will do another one of those debates that we always do. Those are fun. So we'll have one of those. But yeah, I'm on Twitter or X at M_SKI22. Blue Sky is at MSKI22. I also have a link to my Substack from both profiles. I'm putting out a lot of content over there as well. Yeah, just staying busy, loving this off season lull because I can put together more stuff. And I was really thankful that you had me on. So it's nice talking to both of you.
Yeah, I would say for the Dynasty team, off season is not truly an off season because it's really when you're busiest. But
there's no off season in Dynasty.
Yeah, exactly. we're definitely appreciative of all you and the rest of the Dynasty team are contributing right now to the baseball discourse. So, yeah, appreciate that. Thanks for coming on the show.
Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks again to Martin. As I mentioned, we are going to be looking at underperforming and overperforming hitters from last season. Kind of the main thing we're kind of comparing is just WOBA versus expected WOBA, you know, who overperformed, who underperformed. But yeah, just kind of reviewing some hitters and seeing, you know, how did they do? And then what's their fantasy outlook for next year? But yeah, Patrick, who do we've got to talk about today?
Sure. So in terms of like kind of the methodology that I went by, Baseball Savant, ex-WOBA versus WOBA is what I was using. We do have one on our site as well, which is a little bit different, which I'll explain, but I'm just sticking with Baseball Savant, you know, the widely known source. Just set some volume thresholds. So for hitters, it's going to be 400 plate appearances. You know, we don't want those small samples where variance, you know, can be a lot higher. And then ADP inside the top 370, that's in Draft Champions Leagues this month on NFBC. So, you know, there's some guys who are super lucky or super unlucky, like Michael Conforto is one of them. But, you know, for the type of leagues that we focus on, he's not going to be somebody we're considering unless, you know, he gets off to a hot start and he's on the waiver wire. So trying to focus on guys who are a little bit more fantasy relevant. And then, yeah, StatCast, ex-WOBA, just to kind of just explain what it is, because I know that not everybody is familiar with it or uses it in their analysis. Basically, it just takes into account, you know, how hard a ball is hit and the launch angle it's hit, so the trajectory, and compares it to balls in the recent past of, you know, of similar speed and launch angle, and says how likely is that to be a hit, and, you know, how many total bases is it, right? Is it likely to be a double, triple, home run, and produces expected metrics based on that. So doesn't account for sprint speed, right, how fast the hitter is, doesn't account for the park, where the defenders are positioned, or the spray angle of the batted ball. So if it's pulled, taken the opposite field, driven up the middle, you know, all those things. So I think it's a useful tool, but obviously it's not perfect, right? Because it doesn't take all those things into account. And as we'll talk about, you know, there's guys who are able to beat ex-WOBA or who might consistently underperform it because of a variety of factors. And I think that's always important to know. But it is a good metric for the whole league, right? So the league-wide WOBA this year was 313. Ex-WOBA is 315, right? So they're pretty much in line, just a little bit off. And I usually think about it on the same scale as like OBP. League average OBP this year was actually 313 also. So, you know, guys who have like 340, 350 ex-WOBAs, you know, those are borderline elite type hitters, whereas someone under 300, you know, pretty concerning performance. But yeah, we're going to start with the underperformers. So I'm just going to read off the top 10 and then we're going to focus on a few of them. So the biggest underperformer was a 45-point difference in WOBA and ex-WOBA, so that's 0.045, and the top 10 ends at 0.031. So we had Salvador Perez, Juan Soto, Luis Garcia Jr., Ben Rice, Corey Seager, Dansby Swanson, Andrew Vaughn, Otto Lopez, Luis Robert Jr., and Agustin Ramirez. So we're going to start with Salvi. He was 311 WOBA this year versus 356 expected, and that came with a 236 batting average versus 273 expected, and 446 slug versus 522 expected. So pretty big gap there, especially in the slugging department, but he's no stranger to underperformance necessarily of WOBA. So what do you make of, you know, this is a pretty big underperformance here from Salvi, obviously leading the pack. So, you know, what's your concern level here? Do you think he can bounce back a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it is really weird when your ex-WOBA is 86th percentile and then you're just average, right, in terms of your in terms of what you're performing at. You know, the BABIP was down a little bit, and I think more and more, and I should say, the BABIP has kind of consistently been in the high 200s. You know, he got up to even 375 in 2020, but, you know, that's a weird year. Let's throw it out. But this year, after basically being 285 or above for the last four seasons, he drops down to 251 BABIP. You know, I think there's been a lot more discussion on, like, is Kauffman kind of suppressing hitters? You know, it's kind of a weird park, and just park metrics in general, I think. There's, like, a weird thing where it's, like, it suppresses strikeouts, but it also suppresses hitters, which, like, is the weirdest way to explain how a park works. But I'm sure there's some effect of that going on. I mean, in terms of the numbers, like, you kind of see why the ex-WOBA is so high, because he's still hitting the ball, like, super hard. He actually had a max EV this year of 114.8 miles an hour, which is his highest. Actually, it's his highest mark his entire career. That's crazy. So the skills are still clearly there. He had a higher hard hit percentage this year than the past couple years. So I don't know, I'd probably have to chalk it up to maybe just consistency and just getting a little older and maybe not being able to, you know, wield the bat with the same power that you've got at every single at-bat. It is kind of weird, though, just with the numbers he has, that he still ended up with a 95 WRC plus. He's had 30 homers, really low runs, 54, that's kind of expected, but 100 hard RBI, and he still managed an only a 95 WRC plus, and I think it's because that average was so low. And because that BABIP went down, the average went down. Yeah, just weird numbers from Salvi overall. I don't know if there's anything I could chalk up to than just being like, it was a weird, unlucky year. But I don't know. Do you have any other better insight than that?
Yeah, I think overall, you know, you're not too upset with what you got, but you were definitely expecting a better batting average. Even for a guy who, you know, he's one of the slowest players in the league, if not the slowest, and he plays in a tough park, right? So those two factors are definitely working against him. But even still, you know, you would have expected a better batting average just compared to his career marks and his expected marks. And he is a guy who does underperform WOBA pretty consistently. And I think the park has a lot to do with that. but he underperforms it by 15 points for his career, not, you know, the 45 that we saw this year, right? So I do think there's going to be some positive regression there for him. And hopefully the Royals lineup is just better. I think that they're probably committed to that. I think that, yeah, the park is definitely doing some heavy lifting here. I was looking at, you know, the expected home run metrics on Savant. And if he played all his games in Kauffman, he'd have, you know, it's the lowest expected home runs both last year and for his entire career. Then, you know, it's tied for the lowest with parks like Detroit and stuff like that. So I do think in our analysis of hitters, you know, Texas and Kansas City do seem like really more pitchers parks than I think that they get talked about. So I think that does need to factor into our analysis a little bit. But yeah, I don't see this as an age-related skills decline necessarily. So I'm not out on him by any means coming into this year.
Yeah, I mean, you look at his batted ball breakdown and it's not anything inconsistent from previous years, right? The changes that happen are 1-2%. The number I'm probably the most curious about is whether his, because the hard hit rate went up, ground ball rate stayed about the same. I wish this was a stat that, you know, was just readily available instead of searching for it on StatCast, but I am very curious what his ground ball hard hit rate was last year, if that was somehow a little bit worse, which contributed to you know, a worse BABIP and a lower average, just because, like, that's the symptom I see of guys like you know, Vladdy's, I think, like, the number one example of guys who hit the ball. Well, I should say Yelich is probably the number one example, but guys who hit the ball super hard but just hit them into the ground, and you just don't get all that, all those stats when you just look at hard hit rate or look at ground ball rate by themselves.
Right, the best outcome there is a double down the line, but, you know, he's not a guy who's going to leg many of those out, right? So you do have to, you know, kind of elevate to really take advantage.
Yeah.
So number two, I just talked about Texas, and we do have a Texas hitter here, a second, that we're going to talk about. That's Corey Seager. He did clear 400 plate appearances despite, you know, a couple of injuries this year, or I guess one injury and then the appendectomy, which just kind of came out of nowhere. But yeah, he was 365 WOBA, so still strong, but not as strong as his 401 ex-WOBA. 271 batting average versus 290 expected, and a 487 slugging versus 563 expected. So again, a guy who did underperform in batting average a little bit, but underperformed a lot in slugging. And he is a career underperformer at 368 versus 382, but it's not, you know, to this extent again. And like I said, I think Texas was maybe doing some of the work here and, you know, knocking down some balls and, you know, just undercutting what it felt like he should have deserved better at the plate.
Yeah, it's weird because you look at all his expected stats and they're pretty much the same as the year before, right? None of it seems to scream like, oh, there's a serious regression in this specific area. But he actually increased his hard hit rate. His barrels per plate appearance pretty much stayed around the same, 10.9 versus 10.1. I'm just looking at his ground ball rates that, you know, there was a 4% increase in the ground ball rate. Like, maybe that contributes to it a little bit. But it wasn't offset by a difference in fly ball rate. It was offset by line drive rate going down. So, you know, not anything that is really weird. I think that maybe the one weird regression that he had is that his pull air rate went down from 20% to about 12%. I don't know if that really changes his numbers that drastically, though. You might just have to chalk it up to Texas, which is like another really annoying way to analyze this. But that park has been, what, it around for 5 years, 6 years now? I think it opened in 2020. I'm not 100% sure. But nonetheless, like, I think it's been growing from, you know, a hitter's park to a pitcher's park, like you mentioned. I think the stat, the park factors have been slowly kind of indicating, hey, this is actually like a pitcher's park, not a hitter's park like we initially had thought.
Yeah, Seager's a tough one. I do think that he might be a nice discount this year. I know people are getting frustrated with the ability to stay healthy and, you know, he doesn't steal, which can be important for a shortstop, but I think he's still an elite hitter. He had a career high walk rate this year. And you know, that kind of drove him to just a really nice, well-rounded profile. I do think that, yeah, Texas is probably hurting him a little bit, but he still has a great approach at the plate. He does a ton of damage when he does swing. But yeah, I think that the pull air rate might be working against him in terms of he might not be able to eclipse 30 homers like he has in past seasons unless that recovers. If you look at his pull air rates, you know, from like last year and, you know, some times early in his Texas career, those were some of his best power years, and those were some of the times he was pulling the ball in the air the most. So I think that there is definitely a correlation there. And I do worry a little bit if that skill is, you know, declining, but I think that he has a long enough track record that generally I'll feel pretty good about buying the dip on him. And as we're talking about pull air rate, I should just go back to Salvi for a second and say he continued to pull the ball in the air at an elite level last year. So that is not, you know, something that you can point to as to why he might have struggled.
Yeah. I mean, you look at Seager's home runs and a lot of them are kind of congregating around right field, which makes sense. So, yeah, if that does go down just a little bit, where, you know, it's kind of he's hitting maybe to the deeper portions of the park, or hitting it opposite and not just not getting as much oomph on it, then, yeah, that could contribute to that wOBA going down a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. So another guy that we were thinking about talking about was Dansby Swanson. We're just going to move past him, though, and talk about someone who's a little bit more interesting, just debuted rookie. That's Agustin Ramirez, catcher for the Marlins. 302 wOBA versus 332 xWOBA, so not a great wOBA, but he's catching, right, and he also steals, which is rare at the catcher position. So definitely a hitter whose fantasy value is higher than his real-life hitting value. And then in terms of the batting average and slugging, 231 batting average versus 263 expected, and a 413 slug versus a 451 X slug. So the gap in the batting average here was actually almost as big as the gap in the expected slug. So that tells me that maybe there's just a little bit of bad batted ball luck happening here.
Yeah, that's potentially possible. 46% ground ball rate. You know, it's a little, I think that's a little higher than average. I don't have the pitch list page up for him right now, so I don't know exactly how that compares, but a little bit above average, 45%, 40 if you look at stack assets, 46% compared to 44%, so a little bit higher ground ball rate. Couple that with a guy who, even though he does steal a lot, his sprint speed is 31 percentile, right? So he is fast on the bases, but maybe getting from home to first isn't necessarily the quickest, so you know, maybe that could be playing into those numbers being a little different.
Yeah, this one's interesting. I do think, you know what, the other two guys, while I do have some interest in a buy low, this one won't really be a buy low just because of what everything, you know, what the final line looked like, right? He went 21-16 as a catcher, which is really rare. But I could find myself in here even if it's a little bit expensive. I do like his overall approach. I think the batting average was really unlucky. 253 BABIP. And that's with a guy who, like you said, hits a little bit more ground balls than average, but not a lot. He hits the ball hard, right? His max EV, average EV, all that stuff is above average. Hard hits above average. So I don't think, you know, I think he really did merit more of a 260 average than the 231 that he showed or that he posted. I do have some concern that the strikeout rate might go up, right? He has a 11.6% swinging strike compared to a 19.3% strikeout rate. Usually the strikeout rate's about double the swinging strike. So, you know, I have some concern that maybe that will undercut the average a little bit, but I do think with a, you know, just some more neutral batted ball luck, I think that he'll be a guy who hits 250, maybe 255. And at catcher, that's honestly an asset.
Yeah. I mean, you look at a guy who strikes out less than 20% of the time, you'd expect a higher average from that. So, I think I'm with you that there's kind of probably a little bit of, you know, luck kind of not going in his way there. And, you know, positive regression, it could be in line for Ramirez next season.
Yep. Unfortunately, I do think we're going to have to pay up just because he is a, you know, a rookie catcher coming off of a good year. And in our one catcher leagues, that might not be the right move, but I do think in a two catcher, you know, he might be a nice guy to have. So going from the underperforming side to the overperforming side, we have our top 10 here. They range. The highest overperformer was a 0.052 wOBA difference, 2.031 at the end of the top 10. We got Harrison Bader, Nick Kurtz, Jacob Wilson, Hunter Goodman, Shea Langeliers, Isaac Paredes, Sal Frelick, Trey Turner, TJ Friedl, and Eugenio Suarez. So kind of all across the map here. We're not going to talk about Bader, the top overperformer, just because he's kind of on the fringes of the top 370 ADP. But we're going to start off with one of the biggest breakouts, another catcher, Hunter Goodman. He was a 359 wOBA versus 321 expected, 278 average versus 247 expected, and a 520 slug versus 453 expected. So like I said at the beginning, Coors is not accounted for, right? So the Rockies as a team at home typically overperform the expected metric. So that alone is working in Goodman's favor, but he still might be a little bit over his skis here. What do you think?
Yeah, I was trying to figure out his expected WOBA away from home, but it looks like those numbers aren't available. But still a 359 WOBA when he is away, I believe. Let me make sure I'm looking at the right thing.
Yeah, he did have an OPS over 800 on the road and 13 homers. So, you know, clearly he's not doing all his work in course.
Yeah, 340. 340 WOBA when he's away. Very impressive. So, yeah, even though for sure this is like, course is a reason. But, like, he wasn't, like, that bad away from home. If anything, he outperformed his, you know, season ex WOBA when he was not playing at Coors. So, definitely some impressive stuff for Goodman. I think, you know, if you just look at the if you just look at the usual suspects, I mean, insane pull error rate, 25% from him. That was tops in not necessarily the best in the majors, but really, really good. I guess the weird thing is that his exit velos just aren't elite. You know, there's still 66th percentile for his average exit velo, but if he is pulling the ball that much, right, that's just going to help him eke out a little more exit velocity than if he was going for a little bit more of an all fields approach. So I think it's the batting approach for him, you know, trying to pull the ball as much as possible. Obviously it helps that he plays at Coors, but even when he's playing at, you know, other parks, that is going to help as well if he keeps pulling the ball in the air like that.
Yeah. And I think that with Coors, you know, we always think of it as, the ball flies, right? But it's more about actually the space in the outfield and the effects that has on batting average, right? So there, if you look at the three-year park factors on Own Baseball Savant, Coors Field is a 106 in home runs, which is top. It looks like it's sixth. So, I mean, 6% above average. But in terms of batting average, it's so much higher, right? Batting average on contact is 113. And second highest is Fenway Park at 106, right? So 13% above average and way above the rest, you know. So that is able to mask, you know, some of Goodman's, he has a bad approach, right? He strikes out almost five times as much as he walks. But when you're in a place where if you put the ball in play, you got a better chance than anywhere else of getting a hit, you know, that's obviously going to work in his favor and kind of help mask that poor approach.
Yeah, I mean, ground ball rate, 39%. So he is, you know, 43% fly ball rate. So he is getting it into the outfield more consistently. And in Coors, that just tends to drop a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. And going from Goodman to a guy who's got a lot of different profile, but another guy who might be able to, be a perennial ex-WOBA outperformer and kind of has been over his career. That's Trey Turner, shortstop for the Phillies. This year, he was a 352 WOBA versus a 318 ex-WOBA. 304 average versus 271 expected and 457 slug versus a 400 expected. So a lot of the delta here is coming from the batting average, and that's really not a surprise for Turner, right? He's an elite sprint speed guy, and he's actually overperformed expected WOBA by 17 points for his career. And almost all that is from the batting average. His career batting average is 297 despite a 278 expected. So like I said, speed doesn't account, you know, in ex-WOBA. And I'd honestly love to see that. I feel like that could be a really nice development and improve the accuracy of it. But I don't think that's the only thing happening here. But I do think it explains a big part of the overperformance or, you know, quote unquote overperformance.
Yeah, you look at his hit spray chart, which, usually look at that for home runs. But if you look at it for singles, it's actually super interesting. There's a large contingent of singles that he's hitting to third base. And he's just legging out a hit because he's just that much faster than what the third baseman could do in terms of getting the ball in from third base. Ground ball rate at 48%, and yet he's outperforming his expected batting average. 23% pull ground ball rate, which, you know, I don't think you look at that for anyone, but for him who's a righty, like, that's a very interesting thing for him because it just gives him that a little extra time to get to first instead of if he was, you know, hitting to the middle all the time. So there's definitely an aspect here of he's just hitting a bunch of infield singles and making it work because he's so fast.
Right. Maybe not the most exciting, you know, way to get on base, but obviously a hit's a hit for fantasy, and then he can get on and run. And yeah, I was actually looking into that. I can honestly say the first time I've ever searched on Fangraphs for the infield hit percentage leaders, but there you go. Trey Turner is actually first last year. So 13.8% was first in the league. Jackson Churia and Xander Bogaerts right behind him. So you see a lot of speedy guys up there. I mean, his career is like 11.5%. So it's not like, you know, this was just a crazy lucky infield hit year or something, right? You can expect this from him until he stops, you know, showing that elite speed.
Right. And that makes sense why the ex-woba is so low, right? Because a lot of those balls with those types of launch angles, those ground balls, they're not turning into infield hits. But the fact that he's turning what, 13% of them, you said, into hits is going to be a reason why his actual woba is going to be better.
Yeah, and if he stays atop that Philly lineup, right? I know they might not be done signing guys, but they got Schwarber back, and I think it's gonna, you know, they're gonna produce a lot of runs. So I think he's poised for another really nice season.
Yeah, assuming he can stay healthy, but hey, it looks pretty good right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So someone who's probably the exact opposite of Trey Turner actually is the next guy we're gonna talk about. That's Eugenio Suarez, third base, currently a free agent though, which I think looms really large for his fantasy prospects. Last year was a career year pretty much between Arizona and Seattle. 347 WOBA versus 316 expected. 228 batting average versus 212 expected. So obviously both of those pretty poor. But a 526 slug versus a 449 expected. And he clocked 49 homers with 118 RBIs, right? So he was a massive win for anybody who rostered him last year. But do we think it's going to last, or do we think that the price is just going to be way too high? You know, I think that the market continues to get smarter, but you know, it's hard to continuously pass on a guy like Suarez who does have that type of upside.
Yeah, it's one of those guys where, I mean, in our mock draft that we did with podcasters, it always felt like you taking Eugenio in like round 6, 7, 8 just like felt wrong, because you just, again, you didn't know where he was going, but he had already performed this in one of, you know, the, I don't know if worst parks to hit homers in terms of T-Mobile, but, you know, just not a great park to hit homers for sure. And it's like he did that with half of the season there. Like, imagine what he could do in a better park. But it just felt wrong to pick him that early because you just don't know what you're going to get from him. You know, he is going to be 35 next year. None of the stats look particularly good except for the fact that he just barrels the ball like none other. 89 percentile there for him on StatCast. I don't know. It's a really weird thing for him, and I guess the only thing I can point to is the fact that he just pulls the crap out of the ball in the air. 28.6%, well above the league average. I don't know where he ranks necessarily in terms of that number, but it's got to be, you know, probably in the above 80th percentile for sure. So, I mean, if he can continue still do that, like he did that in 2024 as well, 28.6% pull air rate. So maybe there is a kind of concerted effort for him in the last two seasons to be like, you know, this is what I'm good at. I'm going to keep doing it. You know, compared to the seasons before, 23% in both 2023 and 2022. So if he continues his concerted effort to pull the ball in the air, like, you know, we could still see maybe a 40 homer season out of Suarez.
Yeah. That's a deep, deep red there on the StatCast page with the pull air rate. And yeah, I kind of like to look at, especially for guys with extreme splits like this, I do like to go on our player pages and look too, because I like the ex-woba on Savant, but I also like our spray angle adjusted ex-woba. And then this one has him at 341 versus the 348 he actually posted. So a little luck in his favor there maybe, but not a lot, right? So I do think that there is some legitimacy to what he's continuing to do, but I do want to see the destination first. Although I'm thinking about it, and you know, he's got 325 career homers, and I feel like he's a guy who's, you know, he's probably going to want to chase 400, right? And I think that he'll probably sign somewhere where he's going to be able to, you know, to add, to pad those totals. So I don't think that like a terrible destination is likely, like Detroit or Kansas City, right? Something like that. Not that those would be positional fits, but I think I like his chances of ending up somewhere where he does seem to be a reliable 30 homer bat, but you are going to, you know, be biting the bullet a little bit from an average perspective.
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, the challenge with Eugenio is that he's good for homers, he's good for RBI, and he's not really good for anything else. So, I mean, even his defense isn't that great. So you might be looking for a team that's like, hey, we have an open DH position. You know, maybe we bring in Suarez to do that because, you know, he's not a liability at third base, but he's not good at third base in terms of defense. So the number of teams that I think use dedicated DHs are, you know, that number is kind of going down as people kind of see it as more of a way to, you know, give players rest and things like that. But, you know, that might end up being the way he gets onto a major league roster next year, which would be shocking if he doesn't. Obviously he's going to get on a major league roster, but trying to find the team that like specifically just needs a DH, you know, type of bat and guy that hits a lot of homers but doesn't really get on base a ton, right? Like that is that's gonna be something difficult to find.
Yeah, absolutely. So wrapping things up, we're going to talk about a trio of A's hitters, right? You might have noticed when I read off the overperformers list, we did have three A's on there. Nick Hurst, Jacob Wilson, and Trey Langeliers, right? Aside from Brent Rooker, they're pretty much the core of the A's offense, which was really solid last year. And I think a lot of it can be explained by Sutter Health Park, right? And the run-friendly environment there. On the park factors, we do have them as StatCast has them as the second best park behind Coors Field. 108 park factor versus 115 for Coors. So I'm a little hesitant to use 1 year park factors, but obviously that's all we have for this one, right? It's a new field. So yeah, it seems like it's going to be pretty offensive friendly, you know, for as long as the A's do stay there. So I think that these guys will be able to outrun that a little bit, but I think for me, I mean, you can go any way you want with this, but for Kurtz, I'm really concerned about the batting average. You know, I know he hit close to 300 last year and you're going to have to pay for that in drafts. So he's definitely one of my biggest fades, but it's not because, you know, I don't believe in him as like a 35 to 40 homer bat. It's more just like the batting average with a 31% strikeout rate. You know, he's not going to hit 290 again. I feel pretty confident about that.
Well, the funny thing about Kurtz, which, and again, like expected home runs by park is just, it's a fun thing to look at. It doesn't really reveal too much, but he hit 36 homers last year and there are only, not counting Sutter Health Park, right? There are only, I think, four other parks: the Phillies, the Reds, the Brewers, and I guess the Rockies and the Dodgers. So five parks where he would have hit 36 or more homers. Every other park, he would have hit less homers. So it's kind of clear where that distinction between WOBA and ex-WOBA is coming from. It's just that, like, hey, he hits on a park where it gives him a lot of homers. Funny enough, he would have hit 40 homers if he hit every game in Sutter Health. So, I mean, it seems dumb to say, like, that's the reason why there's a difference. And the good thing is that he's still playing there next year, right? So, I think with Kurtz, yeah, I agree, right? Like, the average is probably going to come down just a little bit. But, I mean, his StatCast numbers look great. And if he hits in, you know, a AAA park there's no reason he can't at least have the same number of homers this upcoming season.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't doubt the power. He does struggle against lefties a little bit, but, you know, that's to be expected with a guy who was put in the majors really fast and probably hasn't seen a lot of great left-handed pitching in his life. So I think he's shown to be a good enough hitter that you don't want to say he can't hit lefties, right? I think that would be a little bit judgmental and harsh at this point, but yeah, he's interesting. Jacob Wilson, also super interesting. Seems to be kind of in the Luis Arias mold, except that shortstop, which probably isn't quite as good for fantasy because second base has been pretty rough. But he has great hit tool, right? He seems like a lock to hit 300, you know, for his career, or at least, you know, do it plenty of times. The power was a little bit misleading. I thought at first, you know, just based on his expected slugging is like 360, which is terrible. And he was like kind of he projects as like a 12 to 15 homer guy. But then I was looking at where he's hitting his home runs, and he's just kind of an expert at yanking balls down the line, right? I think he's a guy who he's just such a pure hitter that he tailors his approach to, if he sees a pitch he can hit for extra bases, he changes his swing, right? And he goes out and gets it. Whereas he's pretty content to just line a bunch of other pitches all over the field. So at one point I was, you know, really out on Jacob Wilson because I was like, I can't draft a guy who has 8 home runs and 5 stolen bases. I don't care what his batting average is, but if he can have 12 or 13 home runs and 5 stolen bases, you know, that changes a lot for me.
Yeah, and it's not surprising that his ex-WOBA is so low because he does not hit the ball hard. He's got a 2% hard hit rate. Exit velo, average exit velo is 1%, first percentile. You look at all his homers and they are basically left, right? Like it's barely getting over the wall, essentially, in Sacramento. So it makes a lot of sense why he's overperforming it, because he's managing to, despite the lack of power, still be able to get results with what he's doing with the bat. So it definitely comes down to like really good approach at the plate for him. Doesn't strike out a lot, doesn't whiff a lot, unfortunately doesn't walk a lot either. But nonetheless, I think it's impressive for Wilson, and you know, whether he still is able to, you know, get double digit homers next season. We'll see. I think it's possible, but I think it depends on him kind of taking advantage of his park to be able to get there. Otherwise, I think he's like a really good average play, but I don't really know if there's anything else beyond that besides average and, you know, maybe taking maybe a bit more RBI, maybe a bit more runs. Only 62 from him is kind of surprising. I would have expected that to be higher with his average, but and with that team that he's on. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
he did have the injury. I think he missed, you know, some time, and he's not hitting leadoff, which is kind of weird. That's what you would think, but I guess mm-hmm. the A's like him in like the five hole. He was also hitting second sometimes, but if he can get up to first or second, I think that'd be really nice for his fantasy value, especially with the runs.
Yeah, he's not a particularly fast guy though, so maybe that's playing into it. And yeah, I mean, if he's batting, you know, a little bit further back in the lineup, that's going to reduce his run opportunities for sure, which I think with a guy who gets on base as much as he does, you'd like him to be higher in the order because then you've got the bats of Rooker and Kurtz, Langoliers behind him. But if he's, you know, more in that 5, 6, 7 hole, then it's a little tougher to, you know, want to grab him as your starting shortstop, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And wrapping things up with Langoliers, he made a lot of great changes last year. I know you're a big fan of his, and he went 31-7 stolen bases, 277. So awesome season. The strikeout rate was a career low by a mile, 19.7% versus 26.1% for his career. I think that history has shown that guys who improve their strikeout rate this much typically give at least a little bit of it back, which is kind of baked into the projections right now. So I'm skeptical on the batting average side, but I do think that the power is there. He is a, you know, consistent pull air guy, and obviously playing half his games in Sutter Health is gonna juice those numbers a little bit too. So not a fade on Langoliers, I wouldn't say, but I can't, you know, bet on a repeat at least.
I mean, opposite to the other players that we've mentioned, he actually had a career low pull air rate this past year at 22%,
which is still pretty good.
Still pretty good, yeah. I mean, it's still, you know, top 50 percentile for sure. Deceptively fast. Maybe that's a reason why he's a little bit better, legging out a few of those infield singles more than expected for a guy of his size. Yeah, I mean, I think hitting in that park is obviously very helpful for him. He doesn't necessarily have like incredible Statcast numbers, right? 66 percentile average exit velocity, does have 114.5 mile per hour max EV. So does have, you know, good numbers there, but just a solid guy. But I'm kind of with you, right? Like he saw an 8% decrease in strikeout rate going from 27% to 19.7%. I just don't expect that to stay around. I mean, it doesn't climb back up to the high 20s. I think it's maybe settles around 25, which makes him very serviceable still as well. But yeah, even though the power probably stays, I think the average probably, you know, goes down a little bit. Because what was he at last year? 277. Yeah, 277 average. Expected batting average was like 255. And I think that number makes a lot more sense for the player that Langoliers is.
Yeah, and it's not quite a sellout for power approach, but he does hit the ball in the air a lot. And his BABIP last year was a career high. So when you combine that with the career low strikeout rate, his average obviously shot up. But yeah, I do think he's going to give a little bit of that back. But it could be a really solid, you know, catcher. Him against Ramirez is kind of an interesting, you know, interesting thought. I'd like to see the ADP there. Obviously very different profiles, but both seem like decent options at the catcher position.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that Langoliers probably has a little bit more viability in terms of helping out at more categories. But, I mean, at the same time, it's, you know, definitely possible that Ramirez actually improves a little bit this season because of that positive progression that we were talking about. Yeah, I mean, Shea could be easily, right, like a high 20s, low 30s with 70 to 80 runs and RBI kind of guy, with like a 250 average, and I think that plays pretty well among most catchers.
Yep, he's catcher 3 right now behind Cal Raleigh and just behind William Contreras. So he's ADP 60. You got Ben Rice 71, Hunter Goodman 73, and Agustin Ramirez 80. So if you like him, you're gonna have to go get him.
And this is
draft champions this month. Yep. Wow. So those are the
that's two like catcher, sixth, seventh, you know, round. That's crazy. Which like is
four or five turn in those 15 teamers. So yeah. People are all in.
Wow. I mean, it's funny because if you think about our mock draft, like we didn't, I don't think we drafted catcher till like round 10, 11, something like that. So that's kind of crazy that they're going in round six. But I guess Draft Champions is also two catcher leagues, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that's playing into a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, with the closers and the catchers and in those overall type contests versus, you know, a Yahoo League, it's definitely an apples to oranges comparison a little bit, but you can at least glean something from like how the position is being ranked, right? So him at catcher three, you know, tells me that people are really in this year.
Yeah. Well, so I guess maybe to wrap up the conversation, right? Like how much stock would you take in underperforming and overperforming guys when thinking about drafting next year?
Yeah, it's really tough, right? Because everybody's different. I think it's a great league-wide metric, but obviously some guys have things working in their favor that allow them to beat it or things working against them. So I just try my best to kind of dive deep on the players and know a little bit to as best I can if they were an overperformer or underperformer. I do think that the general strategy of kind of buy low and sell high is really profitable in fantasy, but it's not like you buy low on somebody whose skills stunk too, right? If you're going to buy low on somebody, you want to know that the core skills were there. So that's the type of circumstance where I'd be interested in buying low on an underperformer. And yeah, it's hard to buy high on guys who overperform, but sometimes they just get even better, right? So I don't think that, you know, overperformers should just be crossed off your draft board, but I think you should at least know kind of the context surrounding their performance. Yeah, I think if it's a guy who's coming off like a aberration of a year, that scares me. But when it's someone like Trey Turner, who, you know, has been really consistently at least solid, you know, I'm okay, you know, accepting that he did overperform a little bit, but I think that he can do it again.
Yeah, I do find it interesting also. We talked about four catchers in this one with Legolier's, Goodman, Ramirez, and Salvi. And you know, what's not baked into XWOBA is just the rigors of playing that position, right? And so definitely some things to think about of like, yeah, how does fatigue affect the player? Like, are they, in Salvi's case, right, is he's swapping time between catcher and first base, right? So that gives him maybe a little bit of a leg up on other catchers who are playing every single day, right? Just the fatigue element there. So even though, you know, maybe the real skills don't look as great as the expected ones, you know, if he's going to play more first base next year, then maybe that's something to be excited about. But with that current Royals team construction, I don't know if that's going to be the case. So it'd be something to look at.
Yeah, and they do have Carter Jensen. So it'll be interesting to see how they split time between those two guys. You know, what they think of his defense at this point in his career.
Right, yeah. Are we going to get more DH Salvi? Or, you know, they have a lot of interesting things that they can do with that position. So
I think anybody who hits on that team should play based on how last year went. You know, if you hit, you're in the lineup. That's what they need to focus on.
Yeah, exactly. And shout out to Michael Garcia, who signed a pretty big extension for just doing that last year, hitting a lot. Yeah. So shout out to him. All right. Well, that is going to wrap it up for us this week and really this year. Thanks again to everyone who listened to this year in terms of baseball podcasts. Have a happy holidays. Obviously, we will be back next year with more content. Appreciate you guys sticking with us this entire year and just listening to us talk about fantasy baseball. But yeah, you can find us on This Week PL on Twitter. Send us your comments and questions at thisweekplpod@gmail.com. You can find myself on Twitter at @thejohnka. You can find Patrick at @pfitzgerald_99. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Pitcherless Podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you listen. Leave us a 5-star review if you enjoy the show. Lastly, sign for Pitcherless Pro. By doing so, you could join us in the Discord, get advice from all the fantasy experts and writers over there. We are still talking about baseball all the time. Minnesotans caught a stray a couple days ago because the team sucks, but you know that is what it is on the Discord. We are always talking baseball, so definitely go check that out if you have the itch that you need to scratch. So, that is all for this year. We'll be back next year with another episode of This Week in Fantasy Baseball. For Patrick, I'm John, and we'll see you in the next one. Later, everyone.